President Trump urges Xi Jinping to release jailed democracy advocate Jimmy Lai. Could the president's diplomacy gain Lai's release? Wall Street Journal columnist Bill McGurn reacts. Former Vatican doctrinal chief Cardinal Gerhard Mueller is here to weigh in on the ongoing controversy over the traditional Latin Mass and the emerging Synodal Church. The persecution of Christians in Nigeria continues as a West Virginia lawmaker is calling on the U.S. State Department to act. Congressman Riley Moore is here with an update. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube.
Senator Rick Scott is urging you, along with several other lawmakers, the U.S. Speaker President Xi, to ask for the release of political prisoner and devout Catholic Jimmy Lai.
I might do that, yeah. Well, I have a lot of respect for Rick Scott and a lot of them that are asking me to do that, and it's on my list. I'm going to ask. Look, they're big enemies, so we'll see what happens.
That was EWTN News' Owen Jensen asking the president if he'd advocate on behalf of incarcerated businessman and democracy advocate and Catholic Jimmy Lai during his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. The Lai trial concluded in August in Hong Kong. The judges are still deliberating Lai's fate. Joining me now with Insight, Wall Street Journal columnist and the godfather of Jimmy Lai, Bill McGurn. Bill, thank you for being here. Your Main Street column in the Wall Street Journal this week is titled "The Trump Card That Could Free Jimmy Lai." Bill, you say that by championing Jimmy Lai's cause during that meeting with Xi, the president might make Jimmy's release a win for both the U.S. and the Chinese regime. How so?
Well, for one thing, his continued incarceration is an issue. So it's not helping China. It's bad PR for China. They've made the point. The 77-year-old man has been in jail in solitary confinement for the past almost 5 years. They don't seem to know how to get out of the box they painted themselves into. And Trump could take it off the table for them. Of course, Trump would like it. He said nice things about Jimmy, nice things about his family. And he would like to see Jimmy free, too. Jimmy's very pro-American. In fact, that's why he's on trial. He's on trial for, you know, basically being an American operative, which is absurd. Jimmy's his own man. But it would be win-win all around. And I think there are things that we could give China that they would like in exchange for Jimmy's freedom.
Last week, 38 U.S. senators wrote the president urging him to seek Jimmy's release. The Chinese foreign minister's office, though, Bill, reacted sharply with, quote, strong dissatisfaction and resolute opposition to what it says is interference by the U.S. in China's affairs. Bill, is there power in public shaming the Chinese, or does this just seal Jimmy Lai's fate?
No, I don't think it seals it. The worst thing for a prisoner is to be forgotten. So I think the more his name comes up, the better. It might make negotiations a little hard, but the people I've seen get out from countries, it's never been through quiet back doors. It's always been through someone pressing for them and refusing to let their name be forgotten. Jimmy has a lot of fans in the U.S. I want to say, first of all, EWTN and you have been great in keeping his name out in front of people. The Catholic community in the U.S. is very strongly for Jimmy. There are a lot of people in the Trump administration that are for Jimmy, Marco Rubio being one. So Trump has a lot of support for what he do. The leader of Hong Kong is under U.S. sanctions. Most recently, that prevented him from attending an Asia-Pacific summit in San Francisco, I think last year. We could simply trade that. That's something you know, they might like. So there's a lot you can do. There's a lot on their plate. You know, if he got out of expected to be a package. Also, as you pointed out, they're still haven't come up with the verdict. Chinese system is very different. The British system is very different. The verdict could be several weeks away, and that just drags it out and more bad publicity for China and Hong Kong.
Yeah. Well, Jimmy, as you mentioned a minute ago, he's a British citizen. And the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has himself raised the question of Lai's release numerous times to no avail. What makes you think President Trump, Jimmy, is Jimmy Lai's best hope for release, despite Beijing and Hong Kong's view that Lai is a tool of the U.S., as you mentioned?
Well, they're having talks now. The U.S. is the biggest power. It has a lot of issues with China. So if we can give a little, get a little, that's one way. There's always a lot of things on the wish list of both sides. And I'm glad this is one of them. I just hope more comes out of it because, as you know, Jimmy's not in good health. He's 77, diabetic, medical care. It's not abusive, but it's not the best. And it's very possible Jimmy could just, you know, die in his sleep one month and we wouldn't notice. That would be a pity.
Yeah. Bill, Jimmy Lai's family, his wife Teresa, his daughter Claire, met with Pope Leo on October 15th. This didn't get a lot of coverage. Has that led to any pressure from the Holy See? I mean, we have to be honest here. The Vatican is somewhat of a compromised party because of that still secret Vatican-China deal that they've engaged in that gives China the permission to appoint bishops or at least approve them.
Yeah, not only that, I don't know if there's been any pressure from the Vatican. I don't think they have much power, but it's symbolic. I think the other problem is that the cardinal in Hong Kong is not an outspoken defender of jailed Catholics. And that's putting it mildly. Other people would have much stronger words for him. But that's, in fact, one U.S. A member of the hierarchy, you know, said he's almost like a quisling. Just, you know, not helping the family. Jimmy's probably the most prominent jailed Catholic in the world. And, you know, until the Pope met with Teresa and Claire, there was no sign the Vatican even acknowledged his problem or that he was in jail.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Bill, you're Jimmy Lai's Catholic godfather. You're close to the family, Teresa, Claire, his son Sebastian, who's been on this show many times. How is Jimmy doing? What are you hearing? Frankly, it concerned me when you just said he could die in his sleep.
Well, you know, he has all these illnesses. I have diabetes, too, but I'm not in prison.
Yeah.
I think he just is not in the best of health. He's getting old. He's, again, 78-year-old man. I don't think there's any imminent threat, but there's a constant threat with all these illnesses. And remember, he has no window in his room. Psychologically, what they're doing is incredible. You know, he drew these pictures in jail that he got out before they said you can't send them out anymore. One of them, Cardinal Dolan, put on display at St. Pat's. One is at Catholic U outside the chapel in the business partners. So Jimmy's in good spirits. If you know Jimmy, he'd be more optimistic than all of us. Yeah. But he's a remarkable man. But that takes a toll, especially the solitary confinement.
I'll bet.
But you know what? He has his faith, and he has his family. And if you knew Teresa, she's a rock.
Yeah, it's amazing. They're an amazing people.
I mean,
if you pick
anyone to be by your side, it'd be Teresa Lai. She's a quiet, slim woman, but she is an absolute rock for her husband.
Yeah. I treasure one of those crucifixion drawings that he made. I have it in my office, and it's, you know, I pray before it every day. What a pity, though, that they shut down all his communication with the outside world. But before we run out of time, the president's meeting with Xi was meant to advance a trade deal, gain access to Chinese minerals and rare earths and persuading China to purchase more soybeans, which it looks like they've accomplished to some degree, to finalize the TikTok deal. What is your impression of that meeting and what he got out of it?
I think he got some, but again, the devil is in the details, and we have to find out what those details are, and will China honor all the details? So I think probably some progress is made, but I don't know that as much as we want was made. And, you know, the old adage, trust but verify, that is never more true than when you're dealing with China. Larry Kudlow was on Fox last night. Larry's a good friend of Jimmy's. And he pointed out that that Xi agreed to take on fentanyl like 7 years ago during some meeting. So in some sense, we've been there before, you know, and that's not a reason for optimism, but it's a reason to double down and hold them to the terms of what they agreed to.
Yeah, well, Xi kind of sits there like a grumpy Winnie the Pooh, Bill, and he nods, but you can't take any of this at face value. I mean, he just says these things, which is why my personal belief is keep the sanctions on, let their economy hemorrhage, and then go back to them once they're in absolute moral peril. In fact, that's how Trump got them to the table this time, if we're being honest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as big a fan of sanctions. I acknowledge that they can have short-term effects. Mm-hmm. But once you start going down that route, you know, that's how trade wars and bad policies take place. So I'm one of the skeptics about that. Mm. Where you end up, you know, when you start out, very different intentions than where you land.
Yeah, it all starts ramping up from all sides and sometimes breaks conversation. Right. But I want to get your take on the new prime minister of Japan, Sonai Takaichi, who had the meeting with Trump. She's the first female PM. And it looked like they got on really well. I mean, the president appreciated her promise to accelerate a military buildup while also signing deals on trade with about rare earth metals, et cetera. She's been called, Takaichi, the Georgia Maloney of Japan. Your take on this relationship and the counterbalance with China?
Yeah, I don't know that much about her, but watching her in action, it just reminds me of Japan coming into its own. For all these years, Japan was really number two to the U.S. U.S. took the lead. I think in the future, Japan's going to have to take more of a lead in the region. And I think they're willing to do it. They work well with Taiwan. China's a problem. And Japan is powerful, and Japan can do a lot. So I think Americans should be glad to see her coming into her own.
Yeah, no, she was impressive, and I think Trump was impressed with her. Well, we will leave it there. You can read Bill McGurn's latest column for The Wall Street Journal, The Trump Card That Could Free Jimmy Lai, at WSJ.com. Bill, always great to see you.
Thank you, Raymond. Thanks for EW10's support for Jimmy.
Yeah, he's a great man. Thank you. The traditional Latin Mass returned to St. Peter's Basilica last weekend, despite an ongoing assault against the traditional Latin Mass here in the U.S. What will become of Catholic tradition in the church? And what of the so-called synodality that we see continuing to spread throughout the globe? Joining me now with insights here in Washington is theologian and former head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller. Thank you so much for joining us again. Last time I saw you was in Rome, so I'm glad we're a little more relaxed. Now, Your Eminence, I want to begin with your thoughts on this traditional Latin Mass that was celebrated on October 25th. Cardinal Raymond Burke was given permission to celebrate in the Basilica. Here's my question. Is this a symbol of a thawing of that relationship between the perception the church has, or that Pope Francis had, about the traditional Latin Mass somehow being a hostile force in the church? Is this the beginning of a turn back to what Benedict XVI saw?
Yeah, the form of the Holy Mass or the Missa is only a question of the discipline and not of the doctrine, because all the rites have the same doctrines, the same substance of the representation of the cross, of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ and his resurrection, all these mysteries of the faith. And we have in the same Catholic Church different rites and also different stages of the evolution. And the St. Augustine had a little bit different liturgy, but was absolutely valid realization, celebration of the sacraments. And therefore, we need here more tolerance and more openness. I think our new Pope can distinguish between the necessities in the doctrine. We have the same doctrine, but a certain variety of liturgical rites. Mm. And it's not needed the absolute unity in the discipline, but it's absolutely needed the unity in the same faith, in the same revealed faith, which is the doctrine of the Church, the Word of God, and where we cannot be in relativism in the doctrine and in absolutism in the discipline.
It must be
on the contrary.
Yeah, and the discipline here runs counter to really what the Vatican Council laid down vis-a-vis the liturgy and where Pope Benedict was. Pope Benedict opened this up and said, look, it's the same rite. It's the same Roman rite. Whether it's the ancient rite or the new rite, it's one rite. Allow them to coexist and one sacralize the other. There'll be a mutual enrichment. Pope Francis disagreed with that idea. But we're now seeing this extreme discipline. I mean, you saw the beauty of, and majesty of that procession during the Mass at St. Peter's. My question is, why do you think we're seeing more of an aggressive crackdown, bans, here in the United States specifically?
I think Pope Benedict was a great theologian. He didn't need the council of ideologues who instrumentalized the liturgy for making their politics and not accepting that the liturgy, in whatever form it is the adoration of God and the transmission of the salvation and of the grace. And they wanted to make the liturgy for an example, to give an example of their authority over all of their power. And that is the wrong approach. We must begin with a theological understanding, and then we can resolve these problems in a good way for the salvation of the souls and not only for demonstration of the power a bishop has. It is a wrong understanding also of what is a bishop, no? Wrong understanding what is the role of the Pope, only to make the demonstration of power. It must be the good shepherd. A good shepherd looks to the good, common good of the Church and of the single person. Huh. And not this authoritarianism is not Catholic.
Do you see this as cruel to the faithful, what's happening?
Yeah, I heard from some bishops, they said if they won't accept the newer form of the liturgy, they can remain at home and can go to the Lefebvreans. And that is not a Catholic understanding. No? We must be very open, speak with the people in a good dialogue, in a synodal way, to speak together. And because it's not the question of the doctrine.
Yeah.
With the doctrine, is Jesus through God and man, there is no compromise possible.
You raise an interesting point here. On Sunday, Pope Leo celebrated Mass for something called the Jubilee of the Synodal Teams and Participatory Bodies, a mouthful. He called on the faithful to live, quote, with confidence and a new spirit amid the tensions that run through the life of the Church between unity and diversity, tradition and novelty, authority and participation. We must allow the Spirit, the Pope said, to transform them so that they do not become ideological contrapositions and harmful polarizations. Your Excellency, Your Eminence, this seems to underscore the Vatican's discomfort with tradition and somehow aligning it with polarization. Does tradition lead to, what the Pope said there, ideological contrapositions and harmful polarizations?
There are ideologies inside the Church, but the ideology is this so-called progressism. That is the ideology is splitting the church, because this position is that we can make compromises in the doctrine, in the sacraments, but not the plurality which can exist in the liturgy, you know? And they are making compromises in the moral. They are relativizing the sacrament of the marriage, a revealed truth, with the blessing of homosexual couples. That is a splitting of the church and not the tradition. The tradition is an essential position in the church, the Catholic hermeneutics, the Holy Scripture and the apostolic tradition, but also the ecclesial traditions and the magisterium. That's are the three points of our hermeneutics. And tradition is not, what is tradition? Tradition is the content of the tradition is the revealed doctrine of the apostles,
right?
Where we are knowing exactly that Jesus is the Son of God, is divine. We need also the testimony of the tradition, apostolic tradition.
But why is that secondary? How did we get to a point where dogma has become fungible, and the only dogma we have is you can't celebrate that old mass? That the traditions of the apostles are never heard, but all we hear is quotes of what Pope Francis said 2 years ago.
Yeah. The Second Vatican Council didn't set the liturgy until now, 62, was wrong. It was not a reform of a reality, was old-fashioned or anything, or wrong. But they was only interested in a better, deeper participation of all the faithful in the rite and in the liturgy and the sacraments and the Holy Mass, but it's the same Mass as before. Also the liturgy has not deeply changed.
No. You are celebrating, you're here in the United States, you're going to be celebrating a traditional Latin Mass in Philadelphia. Have you ever seen any miserable or distressing polarization between the adherents of these two rites, the people who attend the traditional Latin Mass as opposed to the Novus Ordo? Why is there such antagonism now, in the minds at least of some in Rome?
I think they are mixing the unity of the Church, which is given in the doctrine, with the same discipline. But with this authoritarianism, they can also say the old form of the Mass is the only valid form, but with what theological reasons. I think that is my reflection, that behind of these actions are not so deep theology, that the people were more ideologues than theology. They must look to Pope Benedict XVI is a great theologian without doubt, and they have to look to him and his understanding of it. Oh, yeah. I can also say I was a professor of dogmatics and of liturgy, and that I cannot understand these people with a so rigorous or without understanding all the only argument they have. We have the authority, and we are deciding it without reason. But in our Christian faith, we have faith and reason. All what is said must be explain it. You can, with arguments, you can explain it. And they must explain why is the older form of the liturgy, what is wrong.
Yeah, what's wrong with it? It's the foundation of the new
same,
Mass.
It's the same. You know, the same.
But we've been hearing a lot lately this assertion that there's no substantial difference between the Novus Ordo and the traditional Latin Mass. In fact, Pope Leo himself touched upon this recently in that now famous interview with Elise Allen over at Crux. He said the following: people always say the Latin Mass. Well, you can say Mass in Latin right now. If it's the Vatican II rite, there's no problem. Obviously, between the Tridentine Mass and the Vatican II Mass, the Mass of Paul VI, I'm not sure where that's going to go. It's obviously very complicated. Now, Your Eminence, Blaise Supich, the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago, said of the traditional Latin Mass, quote, It's more of a spectacle rather than the active participation of the baptized. Your reaction to that idea?
And we cannot say that all the bishops and popes who celebrated in this form was interested in a spectacle. I think that is no theological possible position. It's more spoken to the headlines or anything. Yeah. But with this thesis, you cannot go further in a theological seminary. It cannot pass examination with me in dogmatics.
No. Oh, okay. If you're the professor, what of this idea though that if they want the traditional Latin Mass, they should just go to the Novus Ordo said in Latin. That's good enough. The fact is, they're different rites.
The fathers of the Vatican Council never did say we must invent another form of liturgy because the old form was in any form wrong. The main position was only to make it more possible to follow for the people because they didn't speak Latin and these questions. No? But the rite, the liturgical rite, is the same Latin rite we have now and before since the 6th or the 4th century.
Yeah. So what's the harm of having it celebrated?
I think it's not harm, but also those who are loving the older form, they must be also open to celebrate, surely, in the newer form. And I think the best solution was made by Pope Benedict, and we have to return to it and to avoid these superfluous struggles within the Church. We can struggle with those who are denying the divinity of Jesus Christ, but not who are prefer the liturgy of Chrysostomos or of Cyril Malabar
or any of the ancient rites. But you know, this was all predicated on. You were there in Rome when this was happening. Pope Francis allegedly sent out this. Well, he did send out this form to the bishop saying, you've tried Summorum Pontificum, which Pope Benedict allowed the wide usage of the old Latin Mass. How is it going in your diocese? And it looks like from Diana Montagna's reporting, that came back positive. The bishop said, this is working beautifully. But it was not spun that way by the Vatican. They said, no, this is terrible. It's not going well. And it's creating polarization in the Church. Did you believe that? Do you believe that?
No, I never see a polarization in this question, and I think it was only for demonstration of authority and not so much for the pastoral, looking for the salvation of the soul.
Souls, care of souls.
And otherwise, it's not so good if the Pope is taking over the authority of the bishops, only in the cases of the unity of the universal Church, but not governing directly into the diocese, overruling the authority of the bishops. The bishop has a responsibility. He must have the last judgment. What is good for my diocese, for this parish? And he cannot close this only parish because there is a is an order of Rome. We are not a military organization. But
it feels like that sometimes to the poor people that are, you know, having mass at firehouses and at schools now. Yeah. Like you're being literally thrown out of your parish.
Yeah,
it's a terrible thing. You were head of the Vatican.
It's not Catholic.
No, it's not Catholic. I agree. Mm-hmm. You were head of the Vatican's Doctrinal Office, the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith. This week we saw an ongoing jubilee of education, as well as the 60th anniversary of the promulgation of Nostra Aetate, that very famous Vatican II declaration, which dealt with the Church's relationship with other religions. Interreligious dialogue has been a big theme of this jubilee with Pope Leo. Pope Leo lit a candle of peace at the Arch of Constantine. They ended singing We Are the World as Pope Leo greeted representatives of the various religions. Cardinal Leo, your thought on this event And some of the optics, the very odd video images that we saw of people doing various dances of their faiths in Paul VI Hall. What is the proper role of interreligious dialogue, and is this it?
This dialogue can only make a cooperation in question of the peace in the world and so, but not constituting a same religion. We don't have a world religion. The Catholic faith is based on the revealed truth in Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ is the truth. And we have also to avoid this impression that all in this relativistic culture, that all religions are the same, and all this the expression of a basic religion of mankind. No? Mm. I think that this is not the Catholic faith. No? Mm. And we have to avoid some wrong impressions. No? Mm. Because the Pope is a successor of St. Peter, the vicar of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And they are not different sons of God. It's only one word of God who became flesh in Jesus Christ. And this has to be, we have to underline. The other question is a cooperation in culture and in for the world peace and the cooperation of the religions. But we know there are also religions who don't have another understanding what is peace and liberty and so what is the relation between their religion and the liberty of persons, the dignity of everybody. And we cannot mix it all. We are not fratelli tutti.
There was a line, and I don't have it in front of me, where the Pope said something like, I'm paraphrasing, the church respects the truth in your religions, no matter what it is. Your reaction to that approach to interreligious dialogue?
Yeah, there's a certain form of truth is everywhere in the philosophies. No, in the first centuries, Justin the Martyr said, in Plato, Aristotle, there are certain truths.
Reflections of the truth,
the reflection of the truth, which is in Jesus Christ. But we cannot say we have 30% of the truth and the other have 50%. And so it is not a quantitative reality, but we can say from the standpoint of a Christian and a Catholic standpoint, the fullness of the truth is given in Jesus Christ. This is a person, Jesus Christ, and Jesus Christ cannot be divided. The Church Father said, but there is a little form of truth in the more in the philosophies. They didn't spoke about the religion. They rejected all the Greek and Roman religious, with this pagan, has to do with pagans. Yeah. Only the philosophies have some truth in them.
But not
because
the religious practice.
It's a form of the logos, no? Mm-hmm. It's a split of the logos coming out from the logos. But never they accepted the old religions. No?
Uh-huh.
But nowadays, where the theology is not so highly respected, there's all a little bit mixed.
Yeah, they're getting mixed, at least in the popular mind. When they see an event like that, they go, oh, well, look, they're all the same, see?
Not the religions, but some Thomas Aquinas said the religion is a virtue for the adoration of God. Everybody has in his heart this idea that God must be, or the higher existence must be adored, no? Mm-hmm. But not this so-called concrete existing so-called religions, no? But what the Buddhism is a religion or not, but in this sense, we are not a religion. We are the answer to the word of God and not a self-made religion with some sentimentalities and moral elements and so, and excitement of ourself coming out, and also a little bit so-called spirituality, self-reflected and so self-loving spirituality. No? But we are the rational answer to the word of God, the logos of God.
Mm. I want to talk about the synodal way, which is continuing in your native Germany. And now that spirit of synodality has apparently hit the church in Italy. On October 25th, the Third Synodal Assembly of the Catholic Church in Italy concluded with the overwhelming approval of a final text. It was called Leaven of Peace and Hope. And the document covers the role of women, calling for co-responsibility in decision-making and pastoral ministry. It also explicitly addresses the LGBTQ plus community with this quote, "We will promote the recognition and pastoral accompaniment of homosexual and transgender persons." Your reaction to that, Your Eminence, and what do you think is meant by the recognition and pastoral accompaniment there?
Yeah, it was 900 people, not representative for the Italian Catholics. Was made by these organizations and so, and they cannot speak for the Catholic Church, neither in Italy, neither for the Universal Church. As is a very ideological position they are doing in these 2 points. The collaboration of everybody as lay people is no problem, is no question, but this line in this direction, as if the priesthood and the sacrament of the order in the three forms would be possible in a certain time, later time, for women is absolutely against the Catholic faith and also the Orthodox faith. Yeah. We have this dogma that only man can become bishop, priest, and deacon.
Yeah.
And the other position is, for me, is heretically, because they said in this way, yes, it's only a pastoral for these people in this situation, but they want to equal the marriage of one man and one woman with this homosexual and transgender couples. Mm. And transgender is absolutely impossible. God created man and women, male and female, and this is an open contradiction to the revelation, to the Bible, to the Holy Scripture. Mm. And they are speaking of the Spirit, but this is not the Holy Spirit, the third person in the Holy Trinity, but is the spirit of the ideologies, so in the sociology and psychology, is a self-made spirit of the people and so, but not the Holy Spirit who speaks out what is the revelation of the Son, of the Father.
Before I let you go, I know we're almost out of time. You saw the news headlines, of course you did, you're in Rome, of the Vatican Library granting a prayer space, a prayer room, to Muslim scholars who are visiting. Your reaction to that and what that implies, the Catholic Church saying, here, have your Muslim prayer room right here in the Vatican, without reciprocation, by the way.
Yeah, sure, surely. It's also the time, but they think they will be open and pluralistic and so, but the proof is that this is behind is in relativism. No? And the Vatican is belonging to the Catholic Church, and only on this bottom is allowed the Catholic rite. And if there is not a private prayer, but nearly an official prayer, and that is a self-relativization of the Catholic Church and of our Catholic belief. But I think those who made this decision didn't reflect it deeper. No? Huh. They were only the reaction, oh, we are open, we are good people, why not? And uh-huh. so.
But the theological implications are pretty grave.
It's pretty grave, but it's not deeper reflected. I don't know if there was asked a cardinal and the congregation for the doctrine of the faith, or if the Pope was asked. They are making this decision, not accepting what the Curia Romana is and what the Catholic Church is, that they are the representative of the Church. They don't know the doctrine of the church.
How do you think that's perceived by those in Islam and by Muslim believers?
No, they will triumph, and there we have a footstep inside the Catholic Church, and they will interpret it as a sign that we accept their superiority.
Mm. We will leave it there. Your Eminence, always wonderful to see you. Thank you for your time. And I hope we'll see you again sooner than our last visit. Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down this week with monsters, or at least grandchildren of monsters, Lynn Lugosi and Ron Chaney, the great-grandson of Lon Chaney Sr. and grandson of Lon Chaney, and of course, the granddaughter of Bela Lugosi. And it was an intimate conversation about the human stories behind these iconic Universal Picture monsters, Dracula, the Wolfman, Phantom of the Opera, and the decision by Universal Studios to exclude these classic actors and their images from their new theme park. Why does that performance in Dracula endure today? And why was that decision made to bury him in the Cape, a role that he'd felt at times locked into, Lynn?
Yes. I mean, in his own words, he didn't know whether to call it a blessing or a curse. But he never took for granted that, you know, that role had given him the ability to continue acting, and even though he was typecast. But that was not his request to be buried in his cape. I mean, at the end of his life, he thought he had been forgotten. He would never have imagined that he is still such an icon, a cultural icon, as he is today. But that was the decision of my grandmother and my dad to pay tribute to him in that way. It's
incredible legacy. Who endures 100 years? And I mean, and right. You know, your grandfather has, Ron's great grandfather and father has. There are few people in American culture that have that kind of longevity. Why does your grandfather's role in The Wolfman and all of the various iterations he played afterward?
I think his performance showed a dual nature in man, that we can be, you know, sympathetic and compassionate, and then also be the other way and ferocious. Mm. And the way he played it was, he knew it was coming. He didn't want it. He would kill me. He'd take me out. I'd do a chain. I don't care. But stop me, because I know what I'm capable of doing. And I think that struck a note with a lot of people, like, we're capable of being both personalities sometimes. But he always played it sympathetically. So most of the people that I hear is like, oh my God, I felt so sorry for him. I wanted to help him. You know, I wanted to reach through the screen and give him a hug and try to put him in his agony.
Help the poor guy.
Right.
Poor guy. And I mean, he made it come across that way. And I think with that role in Lenny, he touched that sympathetic chord in us that we all can relate to.
Why did Universal decide to exclude your grandfather's contribution to the prototype of the character of the Wolfman from that Monsters Unchained attraction in Florida?
I wonder myself why I don't understand that. But I think the people that run it now, nothing against them. It's a newer generation. They're not as familiar with that. So I'm not going to throw all the blame on Universal. I think you have different companies own it and different people run it at different times, and they really don't know the history.
Yeah, I get fans contact us all the time, you know, when there's a project that involves Dracula that doesn't feature Bela Lugosi. You know, why is that happening? We want the Bela. And to speak to what Ron was saying, the licensees that we work with, we work with them specifically because they appreciate and respect the original classic monsters. Mm-hmm. And they know that that's who their customers are. They want the original.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Lynn Lugosi and Ron Chaney is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's a spooky show. You will love it. Spotify, Apple, iHeart. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande episode, and it's free. And, of course, Be on the lookout for this Friday's prayerful posse. Ooh, we get into some good stuff. An intense and deadly persecution is going on in Nigeria, primarily against Christians at the hand of Islamic extremists. My next guest is urging Secretary of State Marco Rubio to take immediate action by redesignating Nigeria as a country of particular concern due to the ongoing and violent attacks on Christians across that nation. Joining me now with an update and what he's hearing from the State Department, please welcome U.S. Congressman of the 2nd District of West Virginia, Riley Moore. Did you ever think I'd get through that intro?
Yeah, you got it. You nailed it.
This month on October 6th, you sent a letter to Secretary of State Marco Rubio raising concerns about these horrific attacks against Christians in Nigeria. We've been covering this. Why have the government, particularly the Biden administration, why did they downplay what was happening there?
Well, it's worse than downplay. They removed that designation as a country of particular concern. Mm-hmm. What they said was going on is kind of some intercommunal violence based around climate change. It was climate change is what's causing Islamic extremist terrorists to kill Christians. So it was, which is obviously just false. So that's why we're asking the Trump administration to put this designation back in place. And to be fair here, in the Trump administration was the president who put that on in the first place.
Right. So we're
looking to get that back on.
Well, I guess the Biden administration degraded. They moved it off of the country of particular concern. Why is that designation important, Congressman?
It is important because it gives us different levers in terms of our diplomatic tools, but also gives us the ability to suspend or restrict security assistance, which is training, arming, and equipping the Nigerian military, and gives us a little bit more leverage and get them to do the right thing over there.
And what's the State Department saying?
Well, we have talked to the State Department. They are looking at it. I have talked to the White House staff about it as well. They are looking at this as well. No one's giving us any resistance. Obviously, the president is doing 10 million different things right now. He's brokering deals with China. He's in Malaysia.
Building a big, beautiful ballroom.
Building a big, beautiful ballroom. Doing a lot of things. I know the president, and I know this is something that is close to his heart, and I think once we're able to get this in front of him, I think he will do it.
In July, along with U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, you introduced a resolution condemning the persecution of Christians around the world. What's the status of that resolution? I know it was kind of sidetracked because of the shutdown.
Yes. Now, that resolution specifically was talking about persecution of Christians in Muslim-majority countries, which is really where this is the flashpoint, right? Mm-hmm. That's Nigeria, Syria, the Middle East, any of these countries. This is not a coincidence where this is happening. And so that resolution, we are continuing to pick up co-sponsors for it, but obviously this has all been sidetracked by this ridiculous shutdown that we're dealing with right now.
When is this going to end? I mean, we are moving into the 30th day of this thing. 35 is, I guess, the longest shutdown we've ever been through. This is on track to be the longest. SNAP benefits, food stamps, about to run out on November 1st of money. You sit on the House Appropriations Committee, Congressman Moore. How do you see the shutdown playing out? What's the trigger that will finally open this thing up?
Well, I do think that there is a little bit of light here right now as of late. And the Democrats have been speaking with Republicans, the rank and file, not the leadership, about what if we just start moving some of these appropriations bills and start opening the government kind of one by one.
In bits and pieces.
In bits and pieces, instead of just voting for the CR, which they should do. They should do that so then we can get to the negotiation of actually full funding for the government for the whole fiscal year. But I think that's what you're going to see here is a partial opening, bits and pieces, one by one, moving to reopen the government in totality.
How do you come together in a bipartisan way when the rhetoric is so hot right now? And are you worried about civil disobedience?
Well, I think the way that you get together here is the pressure, which they've created themselves, the Democrats. They're being pressurized on their side. Great example would be the head of the Federal Workers Union has come out and said, vote for this CR, get this done, the SNAP benefits. Look, that puts pressure on me and my district, everybody.
District.
We're all feeling it. So a lot of people in West Virginia depend on SNAP benefits. One in six in West Virginia are on SNAP. We need those benefits. And luckily, our governor has stepped up and is going to backfill some of that right now. But this is insane that this is being held hostage. We are literally holding food hostage so the Democrats get what they want. That's not right.
No. You began your career as a welder.
Yes.
At a mining operation. You've written and spoken a lot about the importance of steel and mining to our economic solvency. You wrote, economic capacity and industrial output are critical in defending the nation and creating a better quality of life. A strong manufacturing sector is in itself a strong deterrent. China understands this, you write. Given that President Trump just met with Xi on this trade deal, how is the United States progressing on the manufacturing front, on that sector, and what needs to be done to really compete with China at this point?
Well, I want to highlight one thing in particular, tariffs. Tariffs are a huge part of that. We can't just, you know, rub our fingers together and say, let's start making things in the United States when no one else is playing by the rules and they're taking advantage of us and our manufacturing base, which they have hollowed out, which we did to ourselves as well. Yeah. That's why we're trying to right set this right now. And those tariffs are going to be critical to reshoring jobs here in the United States, but also creating an even playing field, not just in those countries where it can compete, but here in the United States. So if you want to dump cheap products here into the U.S., you will pay a premium to be able to compete with our great American products here. So this is helping even the playing field for our manufacturers here at home, and it will incentivize more manufacturing.
You are a Catholic, a husband, father of three young children.
Yes.
You also serve in the pro-life caucus, the family caucus in Congress. Chris Smith, the venerable Chris Smith, has come on this show many, many times. Tell us about the state of that pro-life cause, given that you're not dealing any longer with a bipartisan pro-life caucus. You had Democrats on that at one time. That's all gone now. But has the Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court dismantling Roe v. Wade, what has that done? Where has the battle moved? And what is the role of Congress at this point?
Well, the battle has moved to the state level, obviously. That's where it is right now. But I just want to give my own perspective on this. The Supreme Court didn't say this moves to the state level. They said it moves to the legislative level, right? So that could be Congress. I want a federal ban on abortion. That's what I want. Now, if we can get there, you know, people said it was impossible to overturn Roe v. Wade, but that is what I'd like at some point. Now, my state in West Virginia, we have banned abortion. It is 0 weeks in West Virginia. We passed a law after the Dobbs decision. Not a lot of people know that. We are a very pro-life state in West Virginia. But the bad thing is now it's left to the states. We have states like California where it's up to the moment of birth. I mean, which is just a
tragedy. But even in your state, even in Texas, I was just in Texas, the Biden administration loosened the regulations on the abortion pill, which is now available in CVS and Walgreens in communities. So it's a much larger playing field than before, where we were talking about abortion clinics.
Yes, it is. And look, this is something I've been fighting in the Appropriations Committee, and something that I worked on very hard. And to your point, it's no longer bipartisan. The Hyde Amendment. That used to be bipartisanly supported. We just fought about it in the appropriations markup here recently in Labor H. I worked for Henry Hyde. That was my first boss when I worked on Capitol Hill. A great man, a great pro-life warrior. And I'm looking over on that side of the aisle. This used to be a no-brainer, where it was just bipartisan. No longer.
Before you run out of time, I know you were calling on President Trump in addition to the Nigeria redesignation. You are asking him to grant the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian honor, to a man that you call one of the most prophetic voices of conservatism, Patrick J. Buchanan. Now, Pat Buchanan has been a guest on this show countless times through the years. He sat in that chair. In your opinion, what does Pat get right about America? What has he gotten right over the last 20 years? And do you think the president will heed the request?
I think a harder question to answer is what he got wrong. He was right.
Including Where the Right Went Wrong, which was the name of a book.
Go ahead. I mean, he has been correct literally on almost everything. Prescient pieces of literature and books that he's put out over the years, Death of the West being a great one. Go back and read those, and you're living in those times right now. He was literally right about everything. Myself and other colleagues, we are asking for the Presidential Medal of Freedom for Pat Buchanan, and I've even gotten some agreement from some Democratic commentators out there on this that said, you know what, you're right. Because when they do write the book on the America First movement, he will be some of the first chapters in that.
Yeah, this is the when you look at what Trump did, when you look at the Trump agenda, it was all Pat Buchanan stuff. Immigration, tariffs, concerns about China, building up the manufacturing base, concern for the working man,
yes.
pro-life. All those things were the Buchanan pillars that people said he was crazy at the time during the Bush era. They said he was out of his mind.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the sage of McLean.
He came to Weirton, West Virginia in the 90s and told us if we continue down this path with NAFTA, if we continue trade with China, there were 10,000 people working at a steel mill in Weirton at that time. He said, you all are going to lose your jobs. We got 3,000 jobs left there now. He was 100% right.
Yeah, well, that's a medal that's well deserved.
Yes.
Congressman Moore, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Raymond.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Look, it looks like Halloween in here, doesn't it? That black background won't go away. I know.